advertised by TV. Overbearing advertising, god of consumerism, all your crooked pictures looking good. Mirrorism, filtering information for the public eye, designed for profiteering. Your neighbor, what a guy.
Every time you drop the bomb, you kill the god your child has born.
Modern globalization, coupled with condemnations, unnecessary death, Matador corporations, puppeting your frustrations with a blinded flag. Manufacturing consent is the name of the game. The bottom line is money. No, 4,000 hungry children leave us per hour from starvation, while billions are spent on bombs, creating death showers.
Every time you drop the bomb, you kill the god your child has born.
Returning to great speeches and interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Carbon Shock with Mark Shapiro. He reviews the financial front lines of climate change. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can go to axissacramento.org, or you can download this program from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Yeah, in Texas, a gallon of regular costs about $3, while in France it costs $8. Perhaps like yourself, I'm a proponent of wildly increasing carbon taxes in the United States. The question becomes, I think, though, what do you do with the proceeds? If we were to increase carbon taxation in the United States, what do you do with the money? The Harvard economist Jorgensen, in the book Double Dividend, recently suggested that we increase the capital gains tax deduction. So what do you think, sir? What do we do with increased carbon tax proceeds?
Yes. Very totally good question, and a central question, this whole debate. It's very fundamental that the money that's generated from a carbon tax, number one, that at least a significant amount of the burden is placed on the fossil fuel companies themselves. So we just don't have more expensive gas, but the profit ratios stay the same. Two, that basically and every proposal that's been made so far includes what's known as a dividend, which is money that's returned to American consumers. So basically there's a way to do that. So a significant amount of the money goes back to American consumers to kind of offset that extra price for carbon. And that was certainly done in Australia, which, of course, as some of you might know, didn't last too long because the government got ousted. But their program had, I think, a 40% dividend return to the citizens of Australia. So I think that's a key part of the picture, is who ultimately ends up paying. And when we think about a carbon tax, the notion is to create a sense of equity so that some of that money goes back to consumers and goes to dealing with the consequences of climate change, because somebody's got to pay for all those levies. Somebody's got to pay for San Francisco just staying local, buttressing its coast, which, as we all know, is shrinking because the ocean is rising. And somebody's got to pay for those things. Now they're in our general tax pool, but there's a way way to create a targeted fund that would actually enable us to deal directly with climate change. So I think that the answer to your question would be some combination of dealing directly with the cost of climate change plus kicking some of that money back to consumers so that the overall burden doesn't land on us.
Thank you, Mark, for your great work. Could you speak to what extent do you think that the climate change challenge is a challenge based on the capitalist growth model, and that even if we tinker with some fixes here and there in how we grow, that fundamentally part of the equation is the imperative to continually grow and produce more and consume more. Could you speak to that issue a bit? Thank you.
Well, that's a substantive question, Chris. Well, two parts of the of that question. Number one, in writing this book, I was very concerned with how the existing system that we have today could be reformed in substantive ways. Reform is even the wrong word. It's to be made more honest and actually about the cost of fossil fuels. So there's a way actually in which an enormous amount would be gained if we had a system of honest accounting. Nobody goes into the street for the big banner saying honest accounting. You know, it's pretty damn boring. But I tried to make it interesting. I think there's actually a lot of stories in here that illustrate what the hell that idea is. But anyway, this notion, which actually in itself, if you actually did that, you would fundamentally change the kind of decisions that were made in the society when it comes to energy. And I think the fundamental reality, as appealing as that idea is, the appealing is the idea of reducing your consumption as a way to reduce our carbon footprint. I think we can all try to do that in our own ways. First of all, it's very difficult to go tell somebody in India or China to go reduce their consumption because you've had 200 years to enjoy your consumption. So that will not get you very far in the developing world. And as I think, rather than framing it that way, I think if you begin to actually price carbon accurately and you have a mechanism that actually kicks that money back to the social good and actually kicks that money back to helping us wean ourselves off of fossil fuel energy, you're going to end up with a lot less of this kind of consumption, wasteful consumption that we now have. So, then it's a question of less consumption of what? I mean, basically, if you consume more goods at your same level of less carbon intensity, you are actually creating less strain on the atmosphere. So I'm not sure I'm quite ready to jump into this whole notion that people are supposed to start treating this like an ascetic in I didn't write this book to actually have a moral pointing of the finger or an ascetic point of view. I'm not an ascetic. I would bet most of you out here are not ascetic, but you can actually be conscious in how energy is produced and be conscious, much more conscious in the way that society is organized. And that's what I would say in response to that.
We have time for only one last question.
Thank you for your great work. One thing that's come out of the climate science is that they found that there's a great deal of delay between the moment of having actually polluted and the moment when the greatest extent of consequences are felt from that pollution. So climate scientists have found that in the hypothetical where all forms of human pollution right now were to cease, we would still see devastation, pretty significant damage done to our environments going decades out simply because of what we've already put into the environment. And then given certain difficulties with working with governments and the whole host of different challenges that are involved with trying to tackle this problem, isn't it a little bit too optimistic to say that we really have a chance of adequately dealing with this and instead it should be a matter of trying to find a way to survive climate change rather than solve it?
Well,
yeah. Sorry, I'm a bit of a pessimist on this.
I guess so. Let me see if I can address that, your concerns there. One is there's always been a dark life, a dark aspect of human. You know, look at the German expressionists, look at many. I basically think that the way to look at climate change is to, number one, understand that it's happening now, right? So it's not like we're waiting for some apocalyptic thing to happen. You're living through it right now. This is kind of, you know, what is this ridiculous? It's November 25th to have a day like today. gorgeous day, but that's just a small incidental detail, really. But you are already living through climate change, right? So, and you're already paying for fossil fuels. So the decisions that we face now are decisions about how extreme the conditions are going to get, right? We can slow down those emissions, or we can slow them down seriously, you know? And if we do that, the extremity of those conditions that you're talking about will be less. They won't go away. Climate change is already here. So we have to get over this notion that this is something about our grandkids and our grandkids' grandkids. It's actually for us. So the question is, how do we act today to reduce the emissions, to decrease the consequences in the future, and very importantly, decrease the costs in the future? And the Council on Economic Advisers in the United States, from the White House, actually said that if emissions continue on the current level, the costs of climate change are going to increase 40% every decade if things keep going on this level. Obama, I guarantee you, was extremely aware of that report when it came out about 2 months ago, as was every world leader who gathered in New York and are basically and who sat at the table when the Chinese and the Americans sat down to talk about these consequences. So the issue is not, are we going to stop climate change? We're not going to stop it. It's already happening. It's how we deal with the extremities that are coming down the line. And then to add to you, obviously, I think you're right in saying that we need to start allocating resources to deal with the consequences. And by the way, we're already doing that. You know, if you go to New York, they're ready for the next Sandy. You go to New Orleans, they're getting ready for the next Katrina. And you go to the Midwest, and you have all these farmers who are hoping to get through next year, but they were helped by the crop insurance system, which is going to get in more and more perilous condition if we don't act now. So that's my way of flipping your pessimism and turning it on its head and basically saying that the time to act is now. And if you go around the world, it's not like I took a around the world thing, but over the course of 5 years, I went to different parts anyway. I went to London and Manchester and the Amazon and different parts of the United States. And it's incredible, actually, how much is happening around the world. You know, we're kind of like stuck here in America, and we're kind of thinking that we've got this crazy Congress that's kind of frozen in place. We're in this kind of nice state that's kind of at the forefront, more like Europe than it is in like Washington. But there's actually a huge amount that's happening all over the world in small levels. I spent some time in Rio de Janeiro. They have a very far-seeing kind of administration, the city and the state of Rio de Janeiro, trying to do rapid transit system. They're extremely aware of climate change and the impact that's having on Brazil. Same thing in China. Those people are seeing these studies that are happening, the transformation in China. So not to think of yourself as isolated and watching these changes wash over us, but to be aware that all over the world, there's incredible action happening. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to articulate some of these kind of precedent-setting changes that are afoot, because they're happening on big levels, small levels, in parallel ways, simultaneously, in ways that I try to actually evoke the kind of simultaneity of some of this action, try to get across. So I hope that...
Thank you.
Great. Right. Thank you.
Say war and I'm Barack Obama, and I'm here to talk directly to you, the American people. Now, first, I want to address reports that my administration has been running a secret surveillance program. I can assure you, I have no secrets, and now, neither do you. Now, I want to talk straight with you, the American people, about some of the scandals that have plagued several agencies in my administration. Now, of course, for the past several months, I have been giving my full attention to not knowing anything about these reports. I had no knowledge, no clue, didn't have the foggiest notion, and didn't have the slightest idea what was going on. That being said, you should be confident that I am in charge. Now, you all know I wasn't a student, but that doesn't pay. When stuff hits the fan, it's best to be prudent. Here is what I'd like to say. Don't know much about agencies, only what is on TV. Don't know what the DOJ might do, unless by chance I see it on The View. But the FBI plus IRS in my White House have become BS, 'cause the underlings don't speak to me. Don't know much, but please bear in mind that it's best to lead from behind. Don't know much about Libya. On Benghazi questions, just say duh. And if Eric Holder starts to look like he's using Nixon's old playbook, that's a blunder that is news to me. I am not in the loop. Now you all know the right wing keeps pressing, so now I must admit, at least it has stopped them from obsessing lately about my birth certificate.
Don't know much if you're curious. Don't know about Fast and Furious. Hope and change is still in full effect. I just hope they change the subject. I'm the captain of this great big ship, and the country's on a 4-year trip run by Carnival Cruise Lines and me. Thank you.
It's called Smut. Give me smut and nothing but a dirty novel I can't shut if it's uncut and unsut. Tall. I've never quibbled if it was ribbled. I would devour where others merely nibbled. As the judge remarked the day that he acquitted my Aunt Hortense, to be smut it must be utterly without redeeming social importance. Pornographic pictures I adore, indecent magazines galore. I like them more if they're hardcore. Bring on the obscene movies, murals, postcards, neckties, samplers, stained glass windows, tattoos, anything. More, I'm still not satisfied. Stories of tortures used by debauchers, lurid, licentious, and vile, make me smile. Novels that pander to my taste for candor give me a pleasure sublime. Let's face it, I love slime. All books can be indecent books, though recent books are bolder, for filth, I'm glad to say, is in the mind of the beholder. When correctly viewed, everything is lewd. I could tell you things about Peter Pan and the Wizard of Oz. There's a dirty old man. Book like Fanny Hill, and I suppose I always will, if it is swill and really filthy. Who needs a hobby like tennis or philately? I've got a hobby, rereading Lady Chatterley. But now they're trying to take it all away from us unless we take a stand, and hand in hand we fight for freedom of the press. In other words, smut, I love it. Ah, the adventures of a slut. Oh, I'm a market they can't glut. I don't know what compares with smut. Hip, hip, hooray, let's hear it for the Supreme Court. Don't let them take it away. We'll be right back.
That's all, folks.